What does it feel like to wake up and realize you've been catastrophically wrong? Isaac Klein, one of America's most respected meteorologists, discovered the answer on September 8, 1900. The man who had publicly declared that hurricanes couldn't seriously threaten Galveston, Texas, watched helplessly as the deadliest natural disaster in American history consumed his city, his home, and his wife. Over 6,000 people died that night, more than the Johnstown flood, the Chicago fire, and the San Francisco earthquake combined. The tragedy wasn't just about wind and water. It was about the dangerous marriage of scientific arrogance and institutional pride, a cautionary tale that reverberates through every modern disaster where warnings go unheeded. Hurricanes begin quietly, molecules of warm African air rising east of Cameroon, colliding with Saharan winds and monsoon moisture. In August 1900, this atmospheric disturbance drifted westward as an easterly wave, one of dozens crossing the Atlantic each summer. Most fizzle harmlessly, but occasionally something shifts. The science remains mysterious, governed by chaos theory. The smallest change can trigger catastrophe. By late August, the storm gathered strength through a devastating cycle. Water vapor rose, cooled, condensed, and released heat, trillions of molecules breathing tiny fires. Faster winds captured more moisture, releasing more heat, feeding the cycle endlessly. By August 31, it entered the Caribbean as a spectacle of lightning and thunder, with dense foam rising from a gray-green sea, a monster capable of dropping 73 inches of rain in a single day. Late 19th century America was drunk on progress. Factories replaced homemade goods, science seemed to conquer nature, and Isaac Klein embodied this confidence. Despite a Tennessee childhood filled with farm magic, passenger pigeons darkening oak trees, tales of headless ghosts, he chose meteorology because it let him tell big stories and tell the truth. At 21, he believed he could do anything that it was possible for man to accomplish. In 1891, Isaac wrote an article for the Galveston News that would haunt him forever. He claimed the coast was exempt from West India hurricanes and dismissed a previous hurricane that killed 176 people as a minor inconvenience. Most dangerously, he insisted it would be impossible for any cyclone to create a storm wave which could materially injure the city. Galveston abandoned plans for a seawall. Meanwhile, a bitter rivalry festered between American and Cuban meteorologists. Cubans had developed sophisticated hurricane prediction, combining measurements with generational wisdom. Weather Bureau Chief Willis Moore found this embarrassingly unscientific. He banned all weather cables from Cuba except those from U.S. officials, cutting off Cuban forecasts at hurricane season's peak. In the age of certainty, the expected was as good as fact. As the hurricane approached, Cubans recognized what Americans dismissed. Father Gongoid observed persistent moon halos and cirrus clouds, warning the storm showed much more intensity and had turned abnormally left toward Texas. In Havana, William Stockman patronizingly dismissed poor, ignorant natives. By Friday night, Dr. Samuel O. Young noticed unusually high tide despite north winds, a combination that typically produced low tide. He concluded a cyclone was approaching. Saturday morning, Captain George Hicks inquired about the falling barometer. A young weather observer described the approaching storm as merely an offspur of the Florida storm. Hicks retorted, "Well, young man, it's going to be the damnedest offspur you ever saw." Isaac finally raised storm warnings Saturday morning, but the Galveston News downplayed the danger. 8-year-old Henry Cortez played on homemade rafts in flooded yards. Hundreds gathered at the midway to watch enormous waves destroy shops, describing the scene as grand and beautiful. Wealthy businessman Ike Kempner reassured worried visitors, "We have had storms before." Around 4 p.m., Dr. Young discovered seawater nearly topping his staircase. From his second floor gallery, he witnessed massive waves, like the sides of huge elephants, sweep through his neighborhood. Each 50-foot wave generated over 2 million pounds of momentum, carrying pianos with white keys gleaming even in the darkness. He watched his neighbor's house rise like a huge steamboat before vanishing entirely. At 6:30 p.m., Isaac observed open sea where streets once stood. Then the water rose 4 feet in 4 seconds. 50 terrified people crowded into one room as an enormous ridge of wreckage 3 stories tall approached. When it struck, Isaac was propelled into a chimney, thrown underwater, and pinned by timbers. He accepted death. Somehow, he regained consciousness, completely alone. Throughout Galveston, the storm produced nightmare scenes. Slate shingles decapitated victims and severed limbs. At St. Mary's Orphanage, Sister Camillus Tracy and 9 nuns tied 93 children together with clothesline as the building collapsed. They sang hymns as the structure failed. Only 3 older boys survived by clinging to a floating tree. Days later, rescuers found chains of children and sisters still tied together, the ropes meant to save them having entangled them in the wreckage. Isaac stepped into a dawn sky like shattered china. His neighborhood had been scraped clean, houses, friends, everything gone. Bodies lay everywhere, 100 in salt cedars, 43 wedged in railroad bridge braces. At a temporary morgue, Isaac recognized many neighbors, but found neither his wife Cora nor his friends. Body disposal became urgent. Officials loaded corpses onto barges for sea burial, but the dead washed back ashore. They resorted to burning bodies in place, pyres throughout the city, one crew cremating 500 corpses. Ruby Credo recalled, "Every day the stench from rotting bodies got worse. I could barely keep from retching. It was so bad." On September 30, a demolition crew uncovered a woman's body wearing rings Isaac recognized as Cora's. "Even in death," he later wrote, "she had traveled with us and near us through the storm." The official death count reached 6,000, though many believed it exceeded 10,000. Survivors refused to eat seafood for years, knowing what had fed in those waters. Galveston rebuilt with defiance, constructing a 17-foot seawall and raising the entire city's altitude. Yet the January 1901 Spindletop oil discovery redirected America's wealth to Houston, which dredged an inland port considered safer. Galveston's growth stagnated. The hurricane transformed Isaac. He abandoned his earlier work to focus obsessively on understanding the storm's devastation, haunted by guilt over the deaths, particularly his wife's. He died in 1955 at age 93. His brother Joseph died a week later. They hadn't spoken for years. Despite Willis Moore's claim that not once in 1,000 years would Galveston face such devastation, the city was struck by significant hurricanes in 1915, 1919, 1932, 1941, 1943, 1949, 1957, 1961, and 1983. Modern meteorologists warned that warming seas could produce hypercanes twice as powerful as the 1900 storm, yet extravagant homes rise on stilts next to evacuation signs. Isaac's storm reveals that the deadliest disasters stem not from nature alone, but from human arrogance and institutional pride. The meteorologists of 1900 believed scientific certainty had conquered weather prediction, dismissing warnings that didn't fit their models. Their certainty cost thousands of lives. Today, we face similar challenges with climate change and extreme weather. We have better technology, but do we have more humility?